This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, I've been up north looking at the last remaining ferry on the east coast of Scotland and unpicking the mysteries of the gigantic, mysterious Copper Beach.
I went across to Loch Morlach, which sits just at the foot of the Cairngorms, and it is one of the most picturesque places in Scotland that actually has a sailing club. It's inshore sailing, but nonetheless tricky for that. Anyway, the Findhorn Valley lies a few miles just outside Forres. It's a really pretty part of the country. We went there to a place called Randolph's Leap, down beside the river.
Yes. Yeah. And we didn't.
No, we didn't. No, it looked too stupid. But in the valley itself, you'll find Logie Steading. It's owned by the Ling family. It is a really busy place, everything from woodland gardens to a whiskey shop. Pani Ling gave me a whistle-stop tour of the estate, and the first stop was her rather beautiful herd of longhorn cattle.
We've had them here since the 80s. They're the oldest indigenous British breed. Well, the breed was very much developed by Robert Bakewell, but they went out of fashion when the shorthorns came in, because the shorthorns are just that easy, more easily to deal with because they've got shorter horns, or mostly polled now anyway.
What I like about them is that very elegant, very characteristic sweep of horn down right either side of the face.
Yes, and we try, that's what they call the bonnet shape of horn. We try to go for that shape rather than the more pitchforky shape because they do a bit less damage to each other. On the whole, they're very quiet, which is why over the years they've been allowed to keep their horns, whereas other breeds have had them taken off. But they can have moments of, taking again each other and doing a bit of damage.
Can you train the horns into a certain shape?
You certainly can, yes. You can put weights on and you can rasp them and they will grow away from the side that you rasp.
Ah, right. Okay. And why choose longhorns?
Well, years ago, when I was first up here, first married in the late 70s, my husband and father-in-law farmed a single suckler herd, and so every field was full of licorice all sorts. They were every size and shape and colour and everything else, and I said wouldn't it be rather nice to have a field of one breed? And they humoured me, which was very nice, and they said, well, if we could find a breed that would bring something to the suckler herd, then it's something that we could consider. So we had a look at various things, and actually the other thing was to have something that was rare and needed saving, and at the time longhorns were very rare. There were very few of them at the time. So we had a look at various other breeds and decided that longhorns were the ones to have. They are very quiet. They have good mothering instincts. They have good milk. They have these hugely wide pelvises and they produce small calves. Mm-hmm. So they have something to give.
How intensive are they to keep?
Well, we keep them out all year. They have silage, and before and after calving, they might have a wee bit of hard food just to make the whole thing work. And then we finish the stots. We dehorn them because if we do have to get them in to finish them in the winter, it just is better than having horns, and it's easier for the abattoirs too. And we finish them at round about 2 years, and we give them a bit of hard food for the last bit, and we also feed the youngsters through the winters.
They're quite an attractive colour. How do you describe that colour?
Brindle.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are spottier than others. That one over there, she's very spotty. I quite like them with a bit of colour about them. You can end up getting very pale ones if you're not careful. We had a moment of having rather pale ones, but, you know, we try to darken them up a bit.
That one straight in front of us there is sort of basically chestnut coloured and cream.
Yes, yes, she is. But then she's got those sort of black streaks and the always the white stripe down the back and the white blobs on the thighs. And when you cross them, you always get a white tip to the tail. So you can spot a longhorn cross a mile off. It's got the white stripe down the back and a white tip to the tail.
If it's not going to offend them, what's the meat like?
Well, it's pretty good. It's what they call traditional old-fashioned flavour. And we put them through our farm shop here. And we've always used to put sort of five or six bullocks through. And then in the last 3 years, we've put nine through, I think. It's becoming very popular.
You look at some of the continental breeds, you look at the beef, and it's a bit like a slab off Arnold Schwarzenegger. This kind of thing, I'm guessing it's probably more heavily marbled.
It is. It's very heavily marbled. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
So it's actually got veins of fat
growing
throughout the muscle.
It's got veins of fat going through it, exactly. And it is just, it's delicious.
We heard the bell there from the Steading. What all have you got in the Steading? Because this is an interesting range of diversification.
Yes, the Steading was built originally by my husband's great-grandfather, Sir Alexander Grant, who bought the estate back in the 1920s. And he built it as a model farm, which worked very well when there were lots of men and very small tractors and all that sort of thing. And we did actually have the Ayrshires in there where we milked them, and they lived in there during the winter. But when we went out of dairying in the late 80s, the building sort of slightly sat there. We didn't quite know what to do with it. And with a bit of help from the HIE, as it was, HIDB as it was then, we turned it into a series of workshops with a very good cafe and art gallery, and now it's got a whiskey shop and second-hand books and all sorts of other things.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to make the Steading purely retail, so the river paths are open, anybody can come, there's free parking, and we do actually open the gardens. We do charge a small amount there because we need to help defray some of the wages. It's a beautiful place. And this used to be where the dry cow shed was. And this is where the bull pen was here. And he hated the clock, because as the clock chimes, there's something in here that bangs and dings and everything. And he absolutely couldn't bear it. So the clock was never allowed to chime when there was a bull here. This building here was built as a garage or a carriage house by Sir Alexander's son, Robert. And the plans are absolutely fantastic. There is room for 8 Rolls Royces.
Yes.
And there was going to be a house on the top. Well, it's quite a big building. And the house on the top would have dwarfed this. It was huge for the chauffeur and the visiting chauffeurs.
There is a building in Aberdeenshire, because you've got two archways side by side here.
Yeah.
The one in Aberdeenshire, they are set apart, these two, you know, and there are windows between the two. And I thought, why would you do that? It corresponds to the turning circle of a Bentley.
Oh, how brilliant. Isn't that fantastic? How wonderful.
Yeah.
They never finished it because it was being built in the 30s, and then along came the war, and so they stopped building. And then after the war, you didn't have 8 Rolls Royces or chauffeurs or visiting chauffeurs or anything like that. So the top, instead of being a roof, was a floor, but it was so well built that it remained standing, even though it leaked like a sieve.
Do you think you've kind of topped out when it comes to the creativity of what to do with this estate? You know, you're happy with the level now, or are there still new ideas coming in?
Well, our son, he came back to run the place sort of 6 years ago, and he has just opened the boardroom, which is a bit next door here, and a big sawmill up at the top. So that's been opened in the last year. So you never know what's around the corner, do you? But whatever we do, we try and do it so that it works in with what's here. So we try and do a bit of joined-up thinking.
Panelling of Luggy Estates near Forest.
I love that lineup of Rolls Royces. It's a whole different world.
That boardroom that she was talking about is not a director's
boardroom. Well, that's what I thought when I first heard it. No, it's a room of boards.
They've got their own sawmill, so they take full-size trees, cut them into boards that are maybe about, I don't know, 5 centimetres, 7 centimetres thick, depending on what type of thing it is. They kiln dry them, and then they've got a sander that polishes them. So you can use these, I didn't see any that were actually varnished and polished,
right.
But you could do that.
That would be a dining room table and
well,
a half.
Well, yes, it would. It really, you could if you could get two of them from the same tree, half it down the middle, and then it wouldn't matter if the shape of the tree basically was symmetrical on the outside and you got a straight line on the inside, that would be really pretty. You have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, I was just thinking and feeling for the listeners in Singapore and New Zealand and Hong Kong. No idea what you're talking about.
Sometimes I don't have any idea what I'm talking about. It doesn't bother me.
No.
I don't care.
I'm all right.
This year marks the 60th year of the public being able to see ospreys at the RSPB Reserve at Loch Garden. Once upon a time, ospreys were known as fishing eagles. Now, in the 60 years that they've been at Loch Garden, some 2.75 million people have come through their doors to try and catch a glimpse. I caught up with Fergus Cumberland of the RSPB for an update on the inhabitants of the area.
So you should be able to see the nest just over there.
I should be able to, but I can't.
You just walk a little bit over here.
Oh, I got it now. Yeah.
So that's the nest that's been in that position for the past about 30 years. It had been cut down in the past, and we've had different sort of turmoils with egg collectors in the past. Mm-hmm. It's still standing and going strong on a telegraph pole, and it's got a big wooden wagon wheel in the bottom of it. The birds come back every year, and they've been building up that nest every time they come back.
This is the 60th anniversary of this place being open up to the public. 60 years ago, that was a really brave decision.
Yeah, it's been a long journey since that point. If you imagine 65 years ago, the first ospreys came back, and for the first years of them coming back, the nest was robbed consistently by egg collectors. And George Waterston took the view at the time to say, maybe if we actually let the public know what's happening here, to let them know that we have ospreys coming back, that it would change. And a lot of people thought that was crazy to do.
It's kind of hiding them in plain sight, isn't it? You know, you're using an army of people who are interested and caring to stop it happening. Because you can't be vigilant 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week.
Well, exactly. I think if the project was going to be successful and to have it spread further and further with more ospreys coming back into the area, you can't just protect one nest. You have to have people know the story. So as the birds started to spread from this position, people knew what they were facing. And that meant when they came onto land, there was almost like a secret osprey guild of people who were aware.
Little badge under the lapel, yeah. That kind of thing.
You know, apart from this nest, they were kept secret. Uh-huh. And they would tell the project about them. And they would be ringed, those birds that were coming back. And slowly that's now led to sort of 60 years later, 300 breeding pairs of ospreys that we now see in sort of Scotland and the UK.
It's the Scots pine in the distance there that the nest is in amongst. It always kind of surprises me where osprey nests are. It's not immediately beside the water a lot of the time.
Yeah, I think now we're seeing more ospreys take up beside water. And I wonder if that's sort of a growing trend that we will now see that is almost less secretive. And it's a change in selection pressure that you might see. Yeah. That they've decided being close to fish is better than staying away from egg collectors. But this is perfect for ospreys. They want a big open nest. They like to sit in the top of the trees so they can see everything around them. If you ever get the chance to see eagles nesting, they like to have a little bit of cover above mm-hmm. them. Ospreys want it nice and open.
Yeah. Doesn't always work to their benefit, though, because, you mean, the nest sites, I've seen them being attacked by buzzards. I've heard of them being attacked by things like sea eagles.
Very true, yeah. You'll get them. A lot of things that can predate the ospreys. You want to be able to see buzzards coming. You want to be able to see eagles coming. And then you can challenge that, I guess. Yeah.
Our sister programme out for the weekend was very attached to a bird called EJ, which bred for something like 20, 21 years. What's the news on that?
So this would have been her 22nd year if she had returned. So we don't know if she made it to 22 or maybe she died last year at 21. But there's a good chance that because she's not come back, that she's not alive anymore. And that's maybe a good thing. She was getting to be an older bird now, maybe less successful in breeding chicks. The last time this nest was successful was 2016. Mm-hmm. And in all that time, she'd had 25 chicks. So she'd really done her job at that point. Yeah. And it's arguably, yeah, our most famous osprey, I think. She'd come around at the time that the internet was coming around and people started following her online. So EJ had a massive following behind her. It's really nice to be working in the centre and have people come in and kind of tell you their experiences of her as well.
She was a bit of a soap star too, because there were dramas in her life.
I think we like to anthropomorphise her life a lot, yeah.
Yeah, we can't, if it works, it works. Yeah.
We can't help it, you know. We watch her for 6 months of the year when she's here and follow her every move. It's difficult not to give them emotions, I think.
Yeah.
And it has been, lots of ups and downs. I think she's had some tumultuous partners and partners that would come back late, and her eggs would have been kicked out by other males and things. So it's been, lots of interesting seasons here.
Yeah. Is it safe to say nowadays that ospreys in Scotland are now safely re-established?
I think so. They're spreading further and further. They're coming into more areas where they haven't been before, and from the selection pressure from egg collectors has decreased significantly. We might see that migration becomes their biggest problem. If we're getting stronger storms, that could have a greater effect on them. So okay. We just have to wait and see. Again, this year we've also seen a massive decline in fishing stocks as well. That could affect their populations too. So there might be different pressures that come on ospreys.
This is maybe a naive question. Do you still get egg collectors?
You do, but in small numbers. And I don't think they've been successful in taking anything from here since about 1972. And it is also that a lot of these egg collectors are naturalists as well. So when it was made illegal, they sort of transferred over. And that's hopefully what you want to see. People who are engaging with nature and interested by it, they don't feel the same need to destroy it.
So you can still come here to this reserve and have a fair chance of actually seeing the ospreys, or stand down by the loch and have a fair chance of seeing them fishing occasionally.
So they won't actually fish on Loch Garten. The
water's really
too peaty in there. And the only thing they'll get is sort of pike, actually, in Loch Garten.
Fight back.
Exactly. Yeah, the bigger the pike. But there's always a good chance to see ospreys. If you imagine you're in the highest density for ospreys that spread across Scotland, they're always flying over, they're always checking out this nest. And this year's just been unusual in that what often happens is when an osprey dies, another mate would come in to replace them. We've had two of our mates die quite close to one another, and it's left an empty nest there. So we'll wait and see what happens next year. If the ospreys will come back in, there's a good chance that will happen.
Yeah. Even the walk up here to the height, it makes you walking through trees, you know, birch, Scots pine and things. And a sort of slightly damp, slightly claggy, still daylight today. It's just alive with birdsong.
It's amazing, yeah, especially on these rainy days when they're coming down onto the feeders. You could have days where it's been completely quiet, and then you get this echoes of cuckoos coming through the trees, which is fantastic to hear.
What range of birds do you, the small stuff, do you actually get here, aside from the ospreys?
We've actually had our golden eyes that have just fledged as of yesterday. So they're our only tree nesting duck that we'll find in the UK.
And it's just wrong.
Well, this was an interesting project that was also kind of championed here, is that they would have the habitat for golden eyes here with lots of the trees, but just not the mature trees that actually have the hollows inside. And so what they decided to do is they said, maybe if we put up some nest boxes that they'll stick around. And there's a small population of golden eyes that are actually in this area. We get maybe 200 breeding pairs of golden eyes here. And that was fantastic to see one of our other boxes inside that we've been following, Gloria the Golden Eye, who's probably the next biggest star after EJ. Yeah, he's been coming in there. But more specifically to Caledonian Pine Forest, we'll find the crested tit here as well. So it's, again, the only place in the UK that you'll find this species. And in Caledonian Pine Forest, there's 10 times the density of them than you would see in plantation forest. Mm-hmm. So that's fantastic, and a lot of people are coming here to see them.
What do they sound like? Do your crested tit impersonation.
I've been speaking to people. Yeah, sounds a little bit like a.
That's very good. I'm impressed.
I've been working on that for a couple months. Yeah.
Fergus Cumberland of the RSPB at Loch Garten, and let's hope the ospreys make their way back to the site. But I was thoroughly impressed by that impersonation.
Yep.
We've been trying it and failing miserably.
It's one of the hard ones to do, but
yeah.
It's great. The ospreys have been great success to such an extent. I was driving along the road in the Devon Valley last week, mm-hmm. and there was one flying parallel to me.
Uh-huh.
And I got home and said, "I just seen an osprey."
Uh-huh. And they went,
"Yeah." So what?
This is not a competition, and if it was, with that story, I would lose. But I was driving past Loch Garten and I caught sight of something flying on my right-hand side. And again, it paralleled the car for about 60 metres. And it was one of those woodpeckers.
Oh, right.
You know, you just got this flash of red.
And that kind of dipping flight pattern.
Yeah, quite fast, wee things.
Ferries are still an important part of travel in Scotland. But if you go back in time, they were essential for many parts of the rural countryside before the advent of bridges. On the East Coast especially, all the ferries have gone, apart from one. Dr. David Worthington is Head of History at the University of the Highlands and Islands and a ferry enthusiast.
We're standing at the ferry crossing terminal in Nigg, just at the crossing over to Cromarty.
And we get some beautiful days in Scotland, but this is unbelievably wonderful.
We struck lucky today, yeah. And I think it gives us perhaps a deceptive perspective or deceptive view on what the ferry crossings would have been like, because there might have been idyllic days like this, but it would have been a fairly rough crossing at times. The journeys around here are not long, and one of the things that I really am keen to emphasise is that you have four Firth crossings between East Sutherland and Moray, and they're all of less than a mile's length, so they might seem straightforward, but in the kind of what we might call ephemeral watercraft that used these firths, it would have been quite a dicey crossing, and there were serious problems at times.
We're standing, as we said, at the ferry terminal, waiting for the ferry to come in. Historically, how important were ferries for rural Scotland?
I think the ferries around here, and certainly other parts of rural Scotland, but perhaps particularly here, almost define social and cultural life. If you think of the geography of this part of Scotland, you've got these winding firths, these peninsulas. It's a very unusual geography, and it's not a particularly well-known geography. But the way to get about was on foot or by horse and by boat. So it wasn't really a maritime civilization. It was just one that was amphibious, where people looked to land and to sea, but there were short sea crossings that people did, and it was just woven into the fabric of the everyday.
How did they call the ferry? Because you say it's a short crossing, it's a mile. I could shout all I want. I'm not going to attract the attention of the ferryman.
You could try. We might manage today by shouting because it's particularly still. But the general way of signalling was by smoke and fire, or maybe a combination of these things. So all of these ferry crossings, the major ones anyway, had ferry houses or ale houses or change houses right by the shore. Sometimes they were the gurnals, the grain stores, the storehouses that we see around this part of Scotland. And people gathered there and they would light a fire or they would create a blaze to signal to the other side. Now, sometimes some of these firths had regular crossings which you had to pay for, but there's an account from 1689 or 90 from a Moray minister who comes to this part of the Highlands, and he says, though he kindled no smoke, he had to pay a fare, and he's rather disgruntled about this. And there is some evidence of people using flags and also of ferrymen ignoring smoke and fire and just not bothering or being too tired or just unprepared to come across. So certainly wouldn't have worked every day, would it? Because sometimes the har comes in to the extent that you wouldn't have been able to do that. But I think there would have been, it's probably more complex than we think. The signals might have been more than just a I'm coming or I'm not coming.
But these ferries must have lived through incredible times. We've got, you know, the Jacobean Wars. Presumably the ferries would have played a part in all of that.
That's absolutely right, Ewan. And they transported personnel for both Jacobite and Hanoverian armies at the time of the 45, for different allegiances.
But presumably there were a lot of important people using this crossing.
There were, yeah, and Stuart kings used these crossings. Most notoriously or famously, we have the pilgrimage site to St. Duthoc in Tain, which was widely visited by later Stuart kings, most famously James IV, but earlier Stuarts as well. So this ferry from Nigg to Cromarty was known as the King's Ferry for some of its existence.
Because he used it quite a lot, didn't he? I mean, wasn't it just one journey?
No, not at all. He used it quite a lot, and perhaps not always just for pilgrimages. But the people were going back and forth, and we have a lot of travel accounts for people. So certain bishops or other well-known travellers who used these ferries to get about, and early tourists in the Highlands did as well, because I think we have to remember that until the early 19th century, there really weren't many roads in this part of Scotland. There weren't many bridges to connect the mainland, so it was actually easier to use a combination of chaises and horses and ferries to get around than to go any other way. We've got a low-lying strip of land between, say, Ardersier in Nairnshire and East Sutherland here, which is very unusual within the Highlands. It's low-lying, arable land. It's very easy to traverse. If you go inland, it becomes much more difficult. So the hazard of taking a few short ferries probably outweighed the obstacles of travelling inland.
But it was a hazard, though. There have been some nasty incidents.
It was a hazard, and I wouldn't want to downplay that at all. the worst ferry disaster possibly in the whole of Scottish history, but certainly in the Highlands, took place in 1809, and that was the Meikle ferry disaster. That occurred on 16th of August 1809, when people were travelling to a fair in Tain from Dornoch and from other places. Some of them were going on from there, and they tragically drowned in the middle of the Firth, so in the middle of that short ferry crossing across the Firth. And there was a huge relief fund set up to deal with that. Huge amounts of sympathy money came in from local people from across Scotland and across the diaspora, and I think that just emphasised to people that something had to change. And this disaster actually coincides with so many events in Highland history. The building of roads, the building of bridges. It's the same year that Patrick Sellar comes from Murray, and really that signals the start of a massive change that in a few years involves the Sutherland Clearance as the most notorious or infamous, possibly the worst of the clearances to have taken place.
It's nice though that this one survives.
It's lovely, yeah. And this one is, I think, is particularly dramatic in a way because it reduces transport times. It's actually very convenient. If I live in Tain, and if I want to go to Cromarty in the summer, it's much, much quicker to come this way than to drive all the way back to the Cromarty Firth Bridge, much as I like it, and then come back round. And that's about this narrow geography we have, these indented... I think of the Murray Firth as an indented triangle, which has the Murray Firth itself, but also the Beauly Firth, the Cromarty Firth and the Dornoch Firth, and they complicate the geography. But if you can use a ferry, you can travel very easily between Dunrobin Castle in Sutherland and Ardersier. That's only about 24 miles as the seagull flies.
There was a lovely moment as I got on the ferry where a guy came on and paid his fare in eggs.
Oh, well, that's
you need to get some hens.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. There's a record from this very beach, I think, from 1743, of somebody having a cargo of spirits and having to stand around for so long that they decided to open them and drink several pints of these spirits while waiting for the ferry. So all sorts of things went on here. I don't know if the ferryman was paid or not in that particular currency.
Probably bash carry.
Dr. David Worthington and you in there at Nigg Ferry. And if you'd like to see what that looks like, you can find out more about the ferry on a programme called Landward, which you'll find on the BBC iPlayer.
Yeah, it's a fantastic thing. Just two cars, a tiny wee ferry, back and forward all the time. It's just delightful.
Yeah. Loch Morlach sits not terribly far from Aviemore, and it's just at the foot of the Cairngorms, so it's got one of the best views in Scotland. It also boasts its own sailing club. Now, it's inshore sailing, but it's complicated sailing because of the mountains nearby. It does odd things to the wind. Recently, they hosted an open day. Now, too late, you've missed that. Don't worry about that. But I went along to try and preview it and just see what the attraction is.
John Bailey, Commodore of Loch Morlach Sailing Club.
Liz Duncan, I'm the treasurer of Loch Morlach Sailing Club.
And I'm John Newman. I've been a member of the sailing club for probably about 25 years.
We're a relatively small club. Membership must be about 150, I guess. We've got a few club boats that is free for the members to use. The one thing that they love about the sailing club is the views, yeah? And pottering about in boats. It's just an amazing place to sail, yeah?
Just because it is inshore, does that mean it's easier to sail here?
I wouldn't say it's easier necessarily, no. It has its risks here. We're surrounded by land, as you can see. But the wind can be particularly ferocious here at times, and they tend to be lured into a false sense of security, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Because you've got the mountains surrounding the loch, we occasionally get these wind bombs that come from above, which I think is quite unique for a sailing area. And the wind changes direction in 180 degrees sometimes, so it's interesting.
I'm Diana O'Reilly, and I'm the secretary of the Loch Morlach Sailing Club.
I'm Fiona Newman. I'm one of the committee members at Sailing Club.
I confess to being frankly stunned, because I didn't think there was any chance of getting moving on the water at all today. There's no movement on the trees. There's a breath of wind. Why are we moving?
Well, there's enough to blow us along. The Wayfarer has quite a big mainsail, quite a good sail area, but it doesn't take very much to get a little boat going, so it is quite calm, though, isn't it? We might just go out here and then have to paddle back again. You can never tell what the conditions are going to be like, and sometimes we leave home and bring our sailing gear, but also bring our bikes. You probably notice I've got the bike on the back of the car, because when we get here, if there's no wind, then we'll go for a bike ride instead.
You can hear the movement of the foot. Again, I'm astonished we're moving as fast as we are. There's a bunch of canoeists across there, presumably from the beach end.
Yes, at the other end, at the Water Sports Centre, they've got school groups in over these next few weeks before the end of term. I think they've got some canoes and paddle boards, did you see?
Yeah, there were some paddle boards out earlier.
And they've got some dinghies at the waterside there ready to go later on if the wind's suitable for them.
I've only tried paddle boarding once, and it was in the harbour at Dunbar.
All right.
And I don't think there was anybody else in the harbour that was better than me at running backwards off the board.
Right.
I had that down to a fine. The fisherman loved it.
Did you get out the harbour?
I did, but by that stage, I must confess, I was kind of cheating. I was sitting astride the thing and paddling it like a Canadian canoe. I wasn't caring by that stage.
I prefer being in a boat than on top of something.
Yeah. We've a Wayfarer, we've an Enterprise, a 420, we've got three toppers and a couple of smaller boats as well.
Lasers, so basically you've got the full range of kind of dinghies.
Well, that
for
makes
people
about eight boats, I suppose.
Yeah.
And you're not counting the Canadian canoe. I'm sure I've seen a Canadian canoe here.
No, we don't consider that sailing.
Well, the RYA, it's about boating, so if you wanted to bring your Canadian canoe here and potter about and that, we're very welcome, more than welcome.
It's just got such a fabulous view looking up at the Cairngorms from here. Yeah, you're in a totally different world down on the loch.
It's just, I mean, this is it. It's such a busy area in terms of tourism nowadays. Yeah. What would appeal to me about this is this business of actually just taking a boat out here and sitting quietly, just enjoying the peace and quiet, because you can't really hear all the sort of brouhaha on the shore from here.
That's right. Yeah, and particularly over this far side, although people are walking round the loch, they're not right at the edge. You don't really see or hear anybody at all, do you?
The wind's picking up.
The wind's picked up again. Hurrah!
That's better.
Yeah,
we're moving.
You don't need white horses out on the loch to get them move at a fair speed.
There's a lovely photograph in your clubhouse of the boats outside, and they're under about 2 feet of snow.
Yeah.
There can't be many sailing clubs in Scotland that can do that.
Yeah.
Well, it was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago when we were out and the two of us went sailing, and there was a lot of snow on the hills. Yeah. Remember after that last fall of snow? And I got a lovely photograph of everybody rigging the boat with the hills in the background, and there were still people skiing at that point. Yeah.
Sorry, putting tracks up on the hills. Yeah. There was snow down to about the middle station. Brilliant.
We're probably doing about walking speed.
Very slow walking.
Very, very slow. More shuffling than walking. But we're definitely making our way past the boy. Well, this is it.
So we'll come up the wind a bit. And then we'll go about.
I can feel the wind freshening in my side of my face.
A nice little bit. Yeah. Right, ready boat?
Ready.
Leo.
And we'll just try and creep our way back to shore again.
Try and get the wind into the sail a bit better.
I love that gurgling sound as the boat picks up.
If we can get a day like this on Saturday with just a little light breeze, it will be perfect, because then people can go out and have fun, try it themselves, be taken for a sail, and we won't need to worry about them.
As I was saying earlier, you are surrounded by mountains and trees and the light sparkling on the water, and you just couldn't get any better than this.
If you get fed up with the sailing, just look up and look at the mountains and enjoy the view.
John Bailey and some of the members of the Loch Morlach Sailing Club there.
Sounds
I love that sound too.
Soothing.
I mean, seriously, I couldn't see anything that was indicating a breath of wind at all. There was nothing visible at all, and yet
along.
We were just ghosting along the surface of the water. You know, you could see, if you looked where the boys were, you knew you were moving, but it was so gentle and just so calming.
It's a beautiful part of the world. If you're visiting Scotland, going the way up to the ski slopes out of Aviemore, and it is just beautiful orange sand as well.
Yes, the beach at the far end. That's natural sand too. Huh? That's glacial. Not that you're interested at all, but...
Moving on.
Anyway, you're listening to the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, we always say in this podcast we love hearing about where you listen, but we've been in touch by Scott, who lives in Norway. I've been having a rant over recent months about labelling of food, because not all that appears in the packaging is Scottish or British, for that matter. It's quite complicated. But they've got a Norwegian setup called Nyt Norg, and its main aim is to make it easy to choose Norwegian food and drink. You see the label on a wide and varied range of produce.
Apparently, to use it, producers have to prove that the raw materials they use are Norwegian, that the farmer has followed strict Norwegian rules and can document them, and that the food is produced and packaged in Norway. Now, that's all of those things.
Hats off to them.
Yeah, absolutely. We can't get yet in this country, but we're saying it's actually quite a good idea, because if you want to reduce food miles, if you want to actually buy local and have confidence in animal welfare and things like that, you need to be able to track this down.
And so you're supporting farmers that are keeping rural communities going. It's a great thing, and if we can do it in Norway, I see no reason why we can't do it here. Hopefully there are politicians listening that will make that happen.
Well, Scott goes on and says, it was managed by an independent foundation, Matmerk, which was established by the Norwegian Ministry of Agriculture and Food, and adds, maybe it's something that the Scottish Government could look into copying.
Yeah, we'd certainly welcome your thoughts on that. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
Last time round, we got into a bit of a discussion about beech trees, and part of the reason for that is we actually do this from a car park in Aberdeen. Well, it's a living. But we're surrounded by these beautiful, mature trees. I mean, some of them would be 70, 80 feet high, but bang smack in the middle of it is that one, the copper beech. It's probably the most striking of the lot.
It is beautiful, and we got into that debate. How do they become copper? Are they different species? Are they the same species? Well, it turns out it's absolutely fascinating. And there's also some great mythology as well. And it involves a maiden or two. The story of the beech goes back hundreds of thousands of years. A million years ago, there were no beech trees in Britain. But some 800,000 years ago, humans made the wide land bridge crossing from the continent. And with them, they brought food. Food that was to give us the majestic queen of trees, the beech tree. For Stone Age man, the beech tree was a saviour both physically and spiritually. And generations have knelt at the trunk of the massive beech and given thanks. The nuts were a highly portable food that could last the winter. The ancient Greeks claimed that beech nuts, or mast, were the first food eaten by humans. But a word of warning, don't binge on the nuts, as they can, in excess, cause an unwelcome reaction. A problem solved by roasting. Ground down, they were used as flour for baking, and the first flush of leaves are a welcome addition to a salad. But aside from food, the real gift of the beech is that of wisdom and knowledge. A tree long associated with meditation. Lie beneath the broad canopy and drink in the peaceful ambience of a tree that can send its roots back to our ancestors. Get in touch with the past and seek knowledge of the future. And the beech really can pass on knowledge. The first books were written on thin slices of wood bound together, and to the early Anglo-Saxons, the beech tree was called bok, which in time became book. In Sweden to this day, bok means both book and beech, and in German, buch means book and busche means beech. The beech tree is the original way of handing down knowledge for generations to come. It's been worn as a good luck charm, and the soaring branches and canopy of a beech grove are said to have inspired early Christian architects in the design of cathedrals. Used for skin disorders, the tar was a cure for eczema and to prevent the rotting of other woods, creosote. Crushed nuts formed a primitive washing powder, and in Westphalia and Germany, it wasn't the stork that brought babies, they were picked out of a hollow beech tree by the new parents. An amazing tree. But how did the copper beech achieve the rich brown foliage which separates it from its more common green cousin? Scientifically, it's a bit of a mystery. All beech trees have the potential to go copper, but few do. Occasionally, a mature green tree has been known to turn in a season. The reason, again, unknown. Many can be found in vicarage gardens, where it's thought they were provided free of charge to celebrate the Battle of Waterloo. But go back into the mists of time, the folklore and mythology of the Beach of Red, and there may, just may be a tale to be told. And like all good tales, it involves a maiden and a force for evil. Jala ran, her long red hair streaming behind her. She ran and ran till she could run no more. Behind her, the dull thud of the hunter's horse echoed throughout the wood. She cursed herself at being so strong-headed. The elders had warned her against going so often to the beechwood near the village. The trees were good, the gift of food, the gift of healing, the gift of knowledge, but also with it, a danger. For the roots of the beech are a serpent, a snake which winds its way through time and connects with the ancient. Lying still before the beech can induce a trance-like state, which could, just could, take you across a threshold. A threshold into another time and place, a place of good and of evil. Jala had entered that world and embraced the good. She was rewarded with knowledge and love and was gifted the ability of clear sight, of knowing. And on her return, that gift now seemed like a curse. The baron who owned her village came to tell of a new land of milk and honey which was waiting for her kinfolk, if only they would leave their homes. Jala had looked into his eyes and seen the greed for the gold which lay beneath the huts they called home, and she saw the desolation and starvation that awaited the folk of her village. She stood before the baron and defied him to tell the truth. He called his soldiers, and she ran, ran like the wind, her dark red hair streaming behind. As she fell exhausted before the great beech of the forest, she pleaded for help. Softly, in the rustling of the green freshness of the leaves, she heard a voice. Climb, Jala, climb. And swiftly she climbed, nestling in one of the great limbs of the massive beech. Around her the leaves trembled, then quickly, one after another, they changed. They changed from green to yellow to brown and then to red, a dark purple red, the colour of copper. Amidst the new leaves, Jala was invisible, and the hunters rode on. She returned to the village and her kinfolk, who rejoiced. And to this day, the beech of copper has a special place in the hearts of all who love knowledge, learning, and love.
I'm going to campaign to get those stories filmed. I could see you wandering through the countryside in a three-piece tweed suit, you know, one of those really big hairy ones and what have you, and a deerstalker hat and a meerschaum pipe, and just say, so, children, just sit down while I tell your stories.
This very tree that lived the maiden.
Yeah, there's a lot of maidens in your stories.
It's compulsory.
Oh, well, fair enough. Other week, I was in the Oban area, and I was lucky enough to spend some time with wildlife photographer Philip Price. Now, we met up in Oban itself and then took a drive just a wee bit north of the town to a place which has got a fabulous view, and it's where Philip takes some of his photography students.
That's a great sound of oyster catchers.
I know, they're brilliant animals. They are so noisy, yeah, have so much character. Although I always think they look like they're thrown up at some point. But I still love them for it.
Your camera is a bit of a brute.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, basically, you've got a lens the size of a Labrador.
Yeah. It's a funny thing with photography. So what you're asking the camera... Oh, look, some plover.
All right, yeah.
Now, they nest around here as well, so I'm just going to make sure we don't wander near their nest. But I think it's further down the point there, so I think we're all right here.
Okay.
Yeah, so the size of the lens is kind of dependent on your image quality. When you zoom into something, you're asking the lens to gather a lot of light and then essentially bring that light together. And you want to let in as much light as you can so you can get the brightest and sharpest image. And it needs a big chunk of glass to enable that to happen. And that's why these big ones are called fast lenses, because they can have a big aperture, let lots of light in, enabling you to get fast shutter speeds and high quality sharp images.
You can get the comfy bit of rock.
You'd be surprised how much of my job is actually the skill of picking a comfy place to sit. That is definitely my biggest skill set, I think.
Wildlife photography, to make it worthwhile, do you need the kit? Do you need that sort of big chunk of equipment?
So, to make a living from wildlife photography, I could have the cheapest camera if I had pro lenses. Uh-huh. But if I had the best camera in the world and I had cheap lenses, I probably couldn't do it.
Okay.
So if you've got a limited amount of money to invest, I would say 80% spend on lenses and then just pick up a cheap second-hand camera somewhere to stick on the end of that lens, and then you can progress the camera as you get better at your photography.
That's the technical side of things. How about actually approaching wildlife?
So it's interesting to say, I was thinking about this the other day, actually, and I was thinking, what is the thing that I have to be able to make a living from this that other people don't have? And when you do it professionally, it's time. So it's time to have the ability to sit and watch an animal and understand its behaviour without you influencing that behaviour. Because when you take pictures, you do influence that behaviour. Even if you're the best photographer in the world, they'll know there's a hide there, or they'll see you crawling along the seaweed at some point. But what you need to know is, by knowing its behaviour without that influence, you can then know, by coming into their world, are you hindering it going about its daily business? And if you're not, and it occasionally sees you, then that's fine. So most of my time when I'm not with customers is spending time watching an animal, understanding its behaviour, thinking about how I can get me and maybe clients close to that animal without disturbing it, and therefore being able to get really good shots. And we are part of the same world, and it's a two-way process. You know, they're watching you, you're watching them, but you're trying to strike a balance where you are in their world, there's no question. Mm-hmm. But what you're trying to do is be in their world without any way detrimentally making them have to do things differently.
This is a lovely location, though. We're just essentially the north of Oban. We've come up the coast, and the wee island's in front of us. So, not high tide at the moment, and we're sitting just above the seaweed line. It's got that sort of yellow lichen sitting on the top. I can see a couple of herring gulls up there. The oyster catchers have gone quiet. But the panorama here, just talk me through all this. What is all this?
One of the reasons I come here is it's a wonderful place to see the islands, essentially, because on the left there we've got Kerra, and then if you move to the right, that's Mull, and you can see quite a lot of Mull. And you can almost see Benmore, but I think we can just see the sort of right-hand shoulder of what starts off as being Benmore. And then just behind the kind of wee turn island we have here is Lismore. You can see, it's a bit not so great this time of year, but you can just about see how green it is compared to the hills behind it. Behind that, we've got Morven, and then if you keep running your eye to the right, I can't remember where that island is, but to the right of that, you start looking at Ben Nevis and the mountain range associated with that. Yeah. So it's a good panoramic view here. And it's only 5 minutes from Oban as well, which is wonderful.
Coming back to the photography side of things, it was interesting because I was kind of half expecting you with a lens that length to take a tripod.
Now that is really interesting, actually, in terms of the technical side of photography. So even 5 years ago, I would have definitely had a tripod or a beanbag or something to rest my camera on. And about 6-7 years ago, suddenly cameras, you could shoot what we call a high ISO, but the images were still really beautifully clean. And that enabled you to have more sensitivity in the camera. Therefore, you could have a quicker shutter speed. And then if you've got a quicker shutter speed and the camera's wobbling around, it doesn't matter so much. Yeah. So the freedom to now do handheld photography because of these higher ISOs that still give pro-level clean shots means that I now almost never use a tripod. Whereas handheld, you just move your whole body, you are the tripod, and you've got a much better chance of getting a really good sequence of shots.
There's a breeze coming from our left, which means that the water between us and the island, and it's only about 40, 50 metres of water, is ruffled. But every so often, one of those oyster catchers has come off the rock, flown diagonally to our right, alighted on the rock, and then come back again. You think, well, you're not feeding. What are you doing?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I love about my job. I sit there and think that all the time. What are they doing? There's an example. Yesterday I was on Lunga, taking two lovely people out to photograph puffins. And I haven't noticed this before. Maybe others have, but I certainly haven't. And the puffins do this beak clacking thing where they kind of hit their beaks against each other. And I think it's a pair bonding thing. But when they do it, and I've just noticed this yesterday, all, like, at least two or three other puffins, or maybe a couple of metres away, will run over and watch. Mm-hmm. And that's all they do. They don't join in. They just watch. And it's just like, cool, what are you doing? It's amazing. Who's going to win? And then it finishes, and then they wander off again. And then somebody else starts beak clacking, and another group of puffins will circle around. So, and you just think, why? What are they doing?
You're sitting there with a camera with a lens the length of your leg, but right at our feet, there's just a tiny wee rock pool, and by tiny I mean it's like a sort of foot by a foot, and it's not very deep, 7 or 8 inches. But it's the colours contained within that are fantastic. Every so often I'm seeing something. I'm not sure if it's an insect or what it is. It's just moving. I'm catching the movement rather than the shape of the thing. And there's another type of stuff there that's almost translucent. But a lot of that you could pick up with a mobile phone.
Yeah, yeah. And I now do a lot of workshops where people... You could be sitting there looking at something amazing and someone grabs their phone out and takes the best picture of the day with their phone. Slightly depressing, I have
to say. It's irritating, isn't it?
Yeah. Slightly depressing. But also, actually, you have now run workshops where we use phones and iPads and things as the main camera because they are so easy to use. They take such wonderful pictures and you have them with you. And one of the wonderful things about that sort of stuff is that if you use your phone, there's all sorts of incredible websites where you can upload those images. They go into a national database and you get them identified back. So if you get a picture of an insect, you can take a picture, put them onto these places and find out what it is. And it's a really wonderful way of kind of, I guess, using technology to engage in your environment a bit more.
Sound of oystercatchers there. And here in the car park, we've got wrens.
Blackbird.
Pigeons earlier.
Thank goodness we don't have a crested tit, otherwise we'd
You'd have to impersonate it.
I didn't know that about the lenses are so good now. You can use them handheld.
Which is interesting. We both work with a chap called David Williamson, who's one of the cameramen on Landward. There are two schools of photographers, I think. One of them's like David. You know, everything is absolutely immaculate and it's all kept in phone line cases and, oh, dear me, oh, it's got scratch in it, disaster. And then you've got Philip Price, who looks like he's played football with his equipment down the street. He produces beautiful photographs, but it's a rough old game.
Yeah, I never managed it. All I get is sugary images on an iPhone.
Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. And from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, I hear you think podcasts are all about true crime, huh? Well, wise guy, the iHeartRadio app's got all kinds of podcasts. We got stuff you should know and stuff they don't want you to know. We got Bobby Bones, Big Boy, and Lou Later. We got SpongeBob Binge Pants and Exotic Erotic Storytime. We got Doughboys, Two Dudes in a Kitchen, Green Eggs and Dan. Hey, we got ElfQuest. We got podcasts for everything on the iHeartRadio app for free. If you don't download that, well, that's not just a true crime, my friend. That's criminal.